Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, January 13th, 2019. This is episode 1557. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software helping small business owners thrive. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/techguy. And by Slack. Slack is a collaboration hub for work that makes sure the right people in your team are always in the loop and key information is always at their fingertips. Learn more at slack.com. And by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Oh, yeah, Tech Guy time. Oh, yeah. What time is it? Tech Guy time. Time we talk about computers. I know that sounds like a snooze, doesn't it? But it's not. It's fun. It's interesting. The internet, home theater, digital photography. We talk about smartphones. We talk about smart watches. All the doodads, the G-jaws, the gizmos and gadgets that are sucking all the life out of us these days. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free anywhere in the U.S. Or Canada. You could still call toll-free if you use Skype out anywhere else in the world. So it shouldn't cost you anything if you use the right tools. Your plain old telephone's fine in the U.S. and Canada. 888-827-5536. We also have a website where everything that I write down is, is written down by James DeRuvo. So you don't have to write anything down is the point. You don't have to be, as you're driving around, you don't have to say, what did he just say? Oh, let me remember that. No. All you have to do is remember this, techguylabs.com. And you might think with all this promotion that I make something off of that, but no, it's free. There's no sign up. I'm not following you around. I don't care. Just I want you to use it. It's a service provided by the Tech Guy and our fine sponsors, techguylabs.com. There's also a great chat room. Lots of people in there listening to the show, probably watching the football game out of the corner of their eye, that kind of thing. And you can get in there by going to irc.twit.tv. But the chat room has told me they have agreed. Right, chat room? You have agreed. No football spoilers. No spoilers of any kind in the chat room. If you're in the chat room, it's as if you're in one of those soundproof booths that nothing can penetrate except this, my voice, and nothing else. Mike B. in our chat room says, no, you don't understand. Computer geeks have no interest in hand egg or sporting events of any kind. We don't watch out of the corner of our eyes. But we do watch the news, the tech news, and it's always interesting. Of course, this week was the big conclave of geeks in Vegas they call CES, the show formerly known as a Consumer Electronics Show. Yeah, they don't want it to be called that anymore. I don't know why. Which means, of course, that every time I say CES, I also have to say the Consumer Electronics Show, or you don't know what I'm talking about. I could be saying ABC. I could be saying DEF. Then CES. Meaningless until I tell you the Consumer Electronic Show. Some interesting side notes. We've talked a little bit about the TVs that were there. In fact, we had Scott Wilkinson on yesterday, our home theater geek. He walked 25 miles at CES, and he says that that Samsung showed their micro LED TV. This is the first new TV technology since OLED. It's been some time. Micro LED. It's kind of a neat technology because you could make the screen as big as you want, as many pixels as you want, just by patching more micro OLED panels together. Samsung's, 75 inches, the big one? $50,000. Okay, so check that one off the list. That's not going to happen. There were a number of what we call short throw projectors. I'm a fan of those. I use them at home. I have one at home because it gives you the benefit of a projector, a 100-inch screen, without a lot of the downsides. You don't have to put the projector across the room. You can put it right underneath the screen, 8 inches from the wall. Nice. You get pretty good pictures these days, too. In the past, projectors seemed a little washed out. But these screens that these short throws use are designed to reject ambient light. So you don't have to dim the room. They're brighter. And they even look great off to the side, which is an advantage projectors have over, let's say, LCDs, TVs. So pretty nice. There's a number of manufacturers. I have the Hisense one, which has been around for a while. They lent that to me for review, and I was pretty impressed. But LG has announced one now as well, and a company called Optima. You may know the name Optima more from business projectors, but Optima's doing one. In fact, Optima's is the least expensive. The Hisense, which includes a screen, is around $9,000. The Optima is down to $3,000. You still have to buy a screen, but you can get those for under two. So that's probably one to look at. Then there was the guy with his $2,000 Sony camera snapping photos of a self-driving car using technology from a company called AI. I'm sorry. Yeah, AI, but it's not spelled AI. It's spelled A-E-Y-E, like I. I'm AI. And AI car had this thing called LiDAR, which AI makes, on top of it. LiDAR is a really cool technology. So we've seen cars demonstrated that just use cameras, and you can do self-driving cars with around a dozen cameras. It's a little harder. LiDAR is basically an imaging system that gives you the computer in the car, a 3D image of what's going on. So it's a lot more information. But they tend to be more expensive than cameras, lots more expensive than cameras. Nevertheless, most of the self-driving cars you see have those. You've seen them, the spinning things, little spinny things on top, that's LiDAR. Guy taking pictures of the car, Jitray Chowdhury, snapped a photo of the AI unit on the top of the car, and it blinded his camera. There's not visible light isn't coming out of the AI LiDAR, but something is, you know, laser light to measure, you know, to bounce off things. And I guess it was at a frequency the camera could see and boom, burn out the camera. you definitely don't want to focus on laser lights, whether they're visible to you or invisible. If the camera can see it, that's a problem. And they're going to buy him a new camera. But the question is how widespread this problem is. It can't be too widespread because we've seen a lot of, you know, Waymo has a bunch of cars with LiDAR driving around in Arizona. There's cars driving around Silicon Valley with LiDAR on the top. And they're not blinding other cameras. Otherwise, self-driving vehicles, it'd be tough if your car went around blinding other cars. So not sure what's been going on, but that's something to pay attention to. That was just a little inside incident at CES. We saw vertical takeoff and landing helicopters from Bell. Those are the folks who do the Osprey military helicopter. They're making, they say, self-driving flying cars. Oh, we've been waiting for those. We've been waiting for those. Let's see. What else? Amazon dash buttons. Have you seen those? These seem ripe for misuse. I have a few. I immediately hid them. It's a button. Amazon promotes them like crazy. I'm sure you've seen these. It's just a button that with a brand of something on it, Tide detergent or toilet paper or whatever, and you press the button and it'll order it. And so it's like, you know, you put it in your pantry so that when you run low on potato chips, you press the button, Amazon will ship you some more. I just tried it when they first came out. I had a dash button for a Cottonelle toilet paper, and our teenager found it, and we got quite a few boxes of toilet paper, so we stopped doing that. We actually use it here at the studio. My studio manager John has just handed me our battery box inside AAA batteries. But should we run low, actually these are AA's, should we run low, look, there's a little dash button with an Energizer bunny on it. If I press that, John, will more batteries arrive? Yes, he says. Let's just try it and see. Oh, yeah, there, look, the light's coming on. Well,
if it turns green.
If it turned green. We're getting more batteries. We need them, I think. There's only six in here. We don't do anything with them. Okay, well, I'll take them home then. That's okay. Germany has outlawed them. Germany, they got them in Germany in 2016. But yesterday, a court in Munich ruled it doesn't provide consumers with sufficient information about a purchase. I mean, the green light's not enough. And they've outlawed the dash button in Germany. The buttons, the court said, should have a label saying, you just bought something. Eh, maybe. I don't know. I think it's the convenience I like. 80, what do you think? Do you have any dash buttons in your house? It's convenient for Amazon, isn't it? 8888, ask Leo the phone number. I did hide the Cottonelle toilet paper dash button in our house. In fact, I hid it so well, we ran out of toilet paper. I don't know where I put it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Take a little time out, get our phone angel answering the phones, and we'll take your calls right after this. It's the theme song for our phone angel, Kim Schaffer. And I have to say, in this era of Me Too, I did not pick the song.
You have to put a disclaimer on it every day.
Hashtag Leo didn't pick it. Hello, Kim.
Good morning.
Have I ever treated you with anything but the utmost respect?
No.
You had to say that, didn't you?
No.
No? Hello.
I can say whatever I want.
Hello, Kim. That's why we're in separate chambers. So, Kim is our phone angel. She answers all the phones and has been preparing folks for their appearance on this show for hours.
No.
You've coached them? No.
No.
Every time I see that ad, what is it, a Chevy ad where they have people, and now Geico's doing it, or is it Progressive? I think it's Progressive's doing a hysterical takeoff on it. But and there are people, and they're surprised, oh my gosh, there's a truck inside there, or whatever. You know, oh, there's a curtain under the curtain, and then the curtain is another curtain, which is a truck. It's not a Pontiac, it's a Chevy. Because I just read an article the other day that what they do is they go out in the street and they offer people $200 to be in a, you know, one of them meetings, one of them, what do they call those? Test groups, focus groups, a focus group. And they don't know they're going to be on a commercial, but they sign away their lives.
Yes.
And then they're on a commercial. Why do I mention this?
I don't know. I'm. You've confused me. You've completely lost me.
Well, I think we don't offer money to be on the show, but we do.
Oh.
We do get you to call in, and then all of a sudden you hear a bleep, and you're talking on the radio.
Yeah. So the rule is, if you call me, we can put you on the air. But if I call you, I have to get permission.
That's right, because it's presumed you called us to get on the air. Now, the only reason I mention this is because I know there are people listening who are about to go on the air, and I don't want them to be at all nervous. You know, I've done radio for many a year, and I have called into radio shows, and I'm always breathless and nervous.
Don't you, like, aren't you jittery before you get on the air? I've done that, too, and I'm going, I don't
why am I nervous? I do this for a living. Isn't that strange?
Because you and I are talking to each other as if we're only talking to each other.
That's,
yet, and there's millions of people out there potentially listening, and that is terrifying.
Yikes. Excellent point. So we just wanted that we say all of this, not to make you nervous if you're about to appear on the show. You're just talking
Nobody's
to me
listening.
And Kim. Nobody's listening. That may be truer than we wish. Who should I start with?
How about Mark in Tampa, Florida, looking to upgrade his iPhone 5, but is a little confused with this whole locked, unlocked thing.
Oh, I'm not surprised. It is confusing.
It's confusing.
Thank you, Kim. Hello, Mark. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, there. I have to push your button. Now you're being heard by a few dozen people. Welcome to the show. What can I do for you today, Mark?
Good afternoon, Leo. Yeah, I had a question. I've got an iPhone 5 currently, looking to upgrade. I'm kind of looking the websites now to buy a used iPhone, maybe, but I'm thrown off on two things. One, if it says it's unlocked, you can't use it on all the carriers.
Right.
And then there was another website where it had a note that says that if you get an unlocked phone, if you master reset it, it locks it again.
Oh, man. Okay, so it is confusing. It is. In fact, we had a caller yesterday who bought an iPhone on eBay, and it was iCloud unlocked, but it wasn't carrier unlocked, and he couldn't use it. And so there's a there are a number of things to keep in mind here. There's the hardware itself, which has certain radios built in, and sometimes people will buy a phone, say from a European vendor that has the radios for other countries but not the U.S. It may work, but it may not work optimally. It may not even work at all in the U.S. So that's the first thing, is you have to make sure that the phone you buy will work with the carrier and, the, in particular, the carrier's frequencies that you're going to use. That's kind of an abstruse technical issue, and any phone you buy in the U.S. should work just fine. The other thing that happens is there's locking, and there's a couple of kinds of locking. There's what we call carrier locking. And this goes back to the days when you bought a phone, then you'd get a subsidy. You know, you'd buy an iPhone from AT&T. It only costs a couple hundred bucks, but you sign up for 2 years of ongoing payments with AT&T. And if you don't, you know, complete your contract, they'll give you an early termination fee, et cetera, et cetera. When that was going on, they would lock the phone to AT&T. You couldn't put another carrier's SIM in it. You couldn't switch it over. That's called carrier locking. And since those subsidies have mostly gone away, most companies now will unlock the phone as long as it's paid in full. You either bought it outright or you owned it long enough that you own it outright. And you're in good standing and you're still a customer and all that. So then you can carrier unlock it. When that is unlocked by the carrier, that's permanent. That's not going to get locked up again. The third kind of lock is something Apple does, an activation lock. And Apple does this to reduce the number of stolen iPhones. And when you register your iPhone with your Apple account, it immediately locks into you. And no one else can, even if they stole your phone, wiped it, and started over, can use it until you release it. So that's a third kind of lock, and that's more for thievery. Wow. Now, it puzzles me that you talked to somebody that said, well, don't reset it because it'll lock again. Sounds to me like they've got some software on there that's doing something. I would stay away from that one. In fact, be very careful when you buy used phones that you're buying it from somebody legit. If you're buying on eBay, even if they have a high score, you really want to make sure that they know what they're doing and it is completely unlocked and suitable. So for instance, we have an advertiser called Gazelle that sells used phones on eBay. And they say, works on all the major U.S. carriers. That's really talking more about the carrier's radio frequencies. And is unlocked, which means you can then use it on any carrier by putting in a SIM or activating it with that carrier. So you got to be very careful and make sure that that's what you buy. Otherwise, you can get a pig in a poke, a phone that you can't use. Does that all make sense?
Yes, it does, Cleo. I appreciate it. I'll look more into that.
I'd be very careful when you're buying used phones. Buy it from a reputable dealer with a good return policy and one that says explicitly, yeah, these are carrier unlocked and work on all carriers in the U.S. That's kind of what I'd be looking for. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Car guy sitting in front of a car.
Hey, Leo.
Hey. Wow, where are you at home?
Yeah, I'm back at home.
What is that? New York City taxi. Is that a Johnny cab?
This is actually a concept, or at least an idea for a concept that Hyundai showed at CES.
Oh, it climbs steps. It's for handicapped people, in chairs. It climbs
it's
up.
It's got articulated legs with these cool new electric motors at each of the joints.
That's
and
neat.
It's supposed to be autonomous.
So you get in, but that would be a boon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's one of the real issues with automated vehicles is even if it can provide mobility for people who can't drive, you still have the issue of how are people going to get into them?
Yeah.
You know, how are they going to get assistance, the way they would if they were getting a ride from somebody, a human driving the vehicle?
Yeah. Wow, look at that. That's pretty cool. So do you have a green screen? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
Oh, you clever dude. you're a total pro here. But this is
I figured it's better than a cinder block wall.
I like it. I love it. And at first I thought, oh, he's actually like in New York. But then I noticed nobody's moving.
The Detroit Auto Show stuff starts rolling tonight and then into tomorrow.
Oh, that's right. So the CES is right up against the Auto Show.
This is the last year that'll be the case. Next year, the Auto Show is moving to June.
June in Detroit. So what do you want to talk about?
I figured we can hit a few highlights of the show of CES. Talk a little bit about what some of the chip makers are doing since... You know, you always kind of introduce the show with, you know, talking about anything that's got chips in it. Just kind of talk a little bit about how cars have so many chips in them today. Cool. and how that's kind of evolved over the years and where it's going. Had some interesting announcements this week from a bunch of different chip makers, including NVIDIA, Qualcomm, NXP, about what they're doing with automated vehicles and kind of how things are going to evolve in the coming years.
Cool.
And then talk about this concept as well.
All right. We'll talk to you in a minute. Are you a freelancer, a small business person? And I don't mean diminutive. I mean a small business. In other words, do you have a CPA or an accountant on staff? No, of course not. You're the person, right? That was my situation about 10 years ago when I was going to Canada to do the TV show there, Call for Help. And I just hated doing my books. It was just me, so there's no one to do it for me. You know what I really didn't like is doing the invoices. I used to complain about it. Finally, Amber MacArthur, my co-host up there, took pity on me and said, Leo, there's a new company in Toronto. It's great, called FreshBooks. You should go to FreshBooks, freshbooks.com and sign up. And makes it easy to do your invoices. And just in the process of using them for the invoices, you're actually getting your books done too. Wow, was that a revelation for me? It changed my life. And it will change yours too. FreshBooks gets better and better and better, but they're still your best friend when it comes to bookkeeping. I know, you know, you're starting to get ready for tax time, right? It's coming up in a few months. You're probably wishing, I wish I'd kept better track of my stuff last year. Well, make this the year you keep good track of your stuff. Start using FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that puts you in control of your business. Now, I don't like to say this, but it is full industry-standard accounting for users of all levels, even if you're new to accounting. I don't like to say that because I think that scares people. So I like to just say, just do the invoices. Just start with invoices. They'll be professional-looking. You can create them fast. It was helpful for me because it handled different languages, different currencies. I was sending it to Canada. It did Canadian currency automatically. I could take pictures of my expense receipts. It would automatically import them, put them in the invoice. You could see which invoices have been sent, which have been viewed. Yes, viewed. So nobody can say, oh, I can get your invoice. Which invoices have been paid, which have not. They make it easy to, if somebody doesn't pay you in a timely fashion, they make it easy for you to send them notices saying, hey, you know, it's time automatically. But I have to say, you get paid faster. In fact, their studies say on average of twice as fast. Partly that's because when your client gets your invoice, there's a button that says, pay me. Well, it doesn't say pay me. It says, pay Leo now. Pay me. No, it's a button that says, pay the invoice. And clients, it turns out, are just as, procrastinators when it comes to paying invoices as you are when it comes to making invoices. So this really speeds things up. You don't have to have a special account or anything. Just with FreshBooks, you get automatic online payments. You can take them directly from the invoice. You get paid faster. It's more convenient for you, more convenient for your clients. Since you started using it way back when, they've added a whole lot of nice features. You can create proposals for your clients, for new clients, with rich text content and images. You can accept e-signatures. That's all part of the program when they accept proposals. You can send invoices, estimates, and proposals in multiple languages. I love it that it's doing the books because, you see, when it's – okay, so the invoice, that's accounts receivable. When you get paid, that's income. Your expenses are going in there. In fact, they'll even automatically – Connect to your bank account and update expenses daily. So you've got the expenses, you've got the income, you've got the receivables. Wait a minute, that's everything you need to generate real accounting reports and share them with your accountant or your financial advisor. Things like cost of goods sold, other income, general ledger, trial balance, charts of accounts, accountant access, balance sheet. It's real double entry accounting, but don't tell anybody. Don't get scared by that because it just happens in the process of using it. I love it. They've added an accounting and reports tab in the nav bar, too, so you can easily get to those reports. Also new, they've got advanced payments. Mark time as unbilled, because you could do time in hours too, right? Revenue streams, you keep track of different revenue streams. You can charge different amounts for different projects, even if it's the same client. The FreshBook app is awesome too, for not only for getting receipts, but just keeping tabs on your business no matter where you are. And they have not only great award-winning tech support, they're nice people. They're in Canada, of course. Really nice people. But they also have Learning Hub videos that you can watch. I don't think you're going to need them. I think it's just very intuitive, very easy. And man, it's going to transform your life. Because you'll know, for instance, at any time, am I making money? I never knew that until the end, right? Till the tax time. Stop using Word and Excel for billing. That's what I was using. Make 2019 the year you upgrade to FreshBooks. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days. FreshBooks, yeah, free for 30 days. Look, it's January, what is it? It's like the second week of January. It's not too late to make 2019 your FreshBooks year. Get in there. FreshBooks.com/tech guy. When they ask you, how'd you hear about us? Make sure you say the tech guy. That way they'll like me better. They like me a lot. FreshBooks.com/tech guy. I like them a lot. I've been very happy with FreshBooks. They really saved my life. And now it's time for them to save yours. FreshBooks.com/tech guy. Give them a try today. It's Car Guy time. Sam Abolsemid is here, back from CES, where you saw, were there cars at CES, Sam?
There were some cars here in Las Vegas. CES, you know, it's interesting. Over the last several years, you know, everybody started to think of CES as a car show, but it's different from any other of the traditional auto shows, like the Detroit Auto Show that kicks off this evening and then into tomorrow. Where it's not a place where car makers usually go to introduce new products.
They got the Detroit Auto Show for that. They don't need.
Yeah. And what we usually see at CES is, kind of the technology that's 5 or 10 years down the road. The stuff, autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles, and even some stuff that's, coming a little bit sooner. One of the big topics this week was a lot of discussion of integrating voice assistants into cars. Had talks with several different companies, including Amazon, about how they're integrating Alexa Auto into cars, IBM, of course, Google, bringing Assistant into cars. They've pulled it into Google Maps. So, there was a lot of that kind of discussion. But
I remember with Ford Sync had their own voice assistant. My Audi has its own voice assistant. Tesla has its own voice assistant. And none of them hold a candle to any of the commercial, Echo or even Siri.
So, yeah, and that's a big part of why, everybody's trying to pull in these other systems, integrate these other systems into cars. Because I think you've talked about this in the past where, one of the problems with trying to do voice control is it takes a lot of computing power to do that. And so it's been hard to do that consistently, especially in the automotive environment.
And of course, they don't want to put expensive computers in their cars.
Well, but that's what they're starting to do now.
They're going to do that? That's good.
Yeah. A lot of the discussion I had this week with various companies was around kind of where they're going with computing in the vehicle. And so, we've had chips in our cars since the 1970s. I mean, this started when we started rolling out emission controls and fuel economy standards in the 1970s, they started putting a lot of chips into cars, and it's gradually grown. And most modern cars today can have as many as 75 to 100 individual computers scattered around the car, controlling everything from your radio to your fuel injection system to your steering. There's even a body computer that when you press the power window switch, it makes the power windows go up and down, or control the seats and things like that. So there's a lot of these little tiny computers around there. What we're starting to see now is a trend towards fewer, more powerful computers, because all of those computers over the last 30, 40 years, they've been kind of added on piecemeal. As we added a new function, we brought in a new computer for it. We call them electronic control units because, in fact, they're very simple.
More like Arduinos than a desktop PC.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in fact, in many cases, not even that powerful.
Yeah. So this is an interesting issue, though, because the advantage of having all those separate computers is your car. It's harder to hack your car. But with a centralized computer system, controlling the whole car. If somebody were to get into it, your car would be vulnerable. You would be vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, this is one of the issues with going to connected and automated vehicles is the whole security issue.
Yeah.
You know, if your phone gets hacked, you know, yeah, you might lose information. It's annoying.
But it doesn't drive you into the guardrail.
It's probably not going to kill you.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, that may be the case if your car gets hacked.
So I think of the car computers, besides the things like the fuel injection controllers, as being the telematics stuff. Which is kind of the I don't know what is telematics? Is it's the like the OnStar?
And yeah. So telematics is, you know, the connectivity that's been in, you know, that's in cars and it's getting increasingly common. So that's the having a cellular data modem in your car that can communicate with a data center somewhere.
And then there's an entertainment media system, which is often a computer these days.
Yep. And that's separate from the telematics.
One hopes that's separated.
They're separate units, but they're connected together. They can talk to each other. You know, you have a network in the car, so all these things can talk to each other.
And then is there a third, like, computer for controlling the car itself, the engine and so forth?
Yeah, so you have a powertrain computer that controls the engine and the transmission. You've got computers for your electronic stability control. If you've starting to get,
so these are all separate controllers. Are they eventually going to merge into a single controller?
That's definitely the direction that people are going. In fact, NVIDIA and Mercedes-Benz made an announcement on Tuesday that they are going to be developing essentially a supercomputer for the car. I mean, NVIDIA already offers a supercomputer platform for automated driving systems. They call Drive Pegasus.
That's what I'm wondering. Is this being driven by the move to autonomous vehicles where you need a sophisticated computer?
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, and part of it is because we have all these other things and, you know, they're just trying to consolidate them all and make it easier to do things like over-the-air updates. I mean, one of the advantages Tesla had, you know, part of the reason why they were able to do over-the-air updates when they launched the Model S is because they were starting from scratch. They didn't have any legacy computers in the car. So they just built a central computer to begin with. And so they have this centralized system. And that's the direction that the whole industry is going to be moving towards in the next few years. Although we're still going to have, you know, some computers at the edge of the vehicle as well for some of the emergency assistance systems, things like automatic emergency braking. You know, you're still going to have, you know, small discrete computers that are connected directly to the sensors and the actuators.
You don't want a blue screen to stop you from
No, definitely not.
And I noticed this on the Tesla. I can reset the entertainment unit, the big screen in the middle, but the car still drives. Obviously, that's a separate computer function.
Well, no,
it's not.
Actually, I think what's happening is as we go to these centralized systems, we're going to, you know, to hypervisors. So you're getting virtual machines.
I'm rebooting.
So you get one big computer, but, you know, it's running a bunch of virtual machines on there. So you have a hypervisor that manages all that. So you can reset your infotainment system without shutting down the whole car.
That makes sense. So it's a virtual machine and it's rebooting. Wow, I didn't realize that. What operating system are cars using? Are they using Windows, Macintosh? What are they doing?
No, I mean, for a lot of the small computers that are around the car, they don't even really have an operating system as such. They just have, you know, a very simple scheduler that just runs a loop and goes through some
stuff. They're dedicated chips. They're ASICs.
Yeah, some of the more sophisticated things like your infotainment system, in many cases, are running on QNX from BlackBerry or Linux. Linux is getting increasingly popular in a lot of these applications. And there's some other OSs. There's stuff from companies like Wind River. But QNX and Linux are two of the big ones that are powering a lot of this stuff.
Microsoft ran my old Ford Sync, but Microsoft kind of got out of that business.
Yeah, most of the companies, Ford was the main one that was using Windows CE for Sync, and Fiat did some stuff as well, but they moved to QNX. But just to give you an idea of kind of how things have progressed over the last 10 years, the first time I went to CES was in 2008, and I got a ride in the Chevy Tahoe that won the DARPA Urban Challenge. That was my first ride in an autonomous vehicle. That thing had, you know, big SUV. The back end was full of racks of computer servers. It had 10 Core 2 Duo servers in there.
And
it had combined computing power of about 1.8 billion instructions per second.
Okay.
And the the NVIDIA Pegasus system that they're selling now, that they're sending shipping samples to their customers now, is a single board that's about, you know, roughly the size of a typical laptop, like a 13-inch laptop. It's got four main chips on there. It does 320 trillion operations per second.
Wow. Just like everything else, cars are getting smarter. And yep, Sam's going to cover it for us. He's our new car guy. Sam Abul-Samid, he's an analyst for Navigant Research, but joins us every week to talk about technology and how it's changing how we drive. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Leo.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls next.
Hey, Leo, while you're still on the line, since you're now into pens and stuff, I just wanted to make a quick recommendation.
Oh.
The Pen Addict podcast.
I listen. I know.
Oh, okay. With,
Mike Hurley. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
all right.
Yeah.
Cool.
In fact, it's because of Mike that I bought this. This is the 40-year-old pen that is actually now my new favorite pen. It's a beautiful Pilot Murex, and it's so are you a pen guy?
No, not at all.
Oh.
I use pens only just to take notes when I'm doing interviews and when I'm in meetings but
I kind of out of control here.
My handwriting is atrocious.
Well, mine is too. Yeah.
But I grab whatever is handy, whatever writing implement is handy.
I was a pen guy in my teens, and I was really, you know, kind of into fountain pens because my mom used one and my dad used them. And then I kind of, you know, I went through a phase of getting fancy, you know, ones like Mont Blancs, which I would promptly lose. So then I thought, this is terrible. I shouldn't be doing this. But now if I take good care of them, my goal is to get my handwriting better so that I can actually handwrite stuff. So I think the more I write, the better my handwriting will be, I hope.
I handwrite a lot of stuff in meetings and
doesn't
interviews.
Help.
I find that it really does. You know, I mean, there's been these studies that show that if you handwrite stuff, it helps with your memory.
I think so.
So
yeah.
even though I end up not actually going back and referencing my notes very often, I find that it actually does help me to remember the things that I hear when I'm taking notes.
Yeah. For a while, I was just buying Pilot makes a disposable called the Varsity, and I just bought cases of the Varsity. And then you don't have to refill them or anything. You throw them out. But, everybody knows my phone.
The nice thing about going to, you know, all kinds of media briefings and events and that, they always have notebooks and pens, reporters' notebooks and pens all over the place.
Right.
So I always grab, you know, so I always have lots of office supplies. So I have lots and lots of pens and notebooks.
Lots of gimme pens. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Sam, you're doing great. It's fantastic. As you notice, I derail you. So. It's a good thing to think about what you want to talk about, just be prepared for me to completely derail the conversation.
If you've listened to Wheel Bearings, you know that Dan and I go off on tangents all the time.
I like to make it a little informal and just more of a conversation. So if I hear something, given what I know about the audience and stuff, I will sometimes direct you. Like I wanted to talk more about what the operating systems were and what the processors were and stuff. And you picked up on that cue exactly. So that's just because I think that way it's not just about cars. But I think as time goes by, I think it'll be more and more about cars because I think.
Yeah. Next week, I want to start getting into, some of the stuff around automated driving technologies and, you know, maybe what the different levels mean. And
I'm content just to hear you give us a report from the Detroit Auto Show, frankly.
Yeah.
You can say what the two cars you saw or the five cars you saw that were really cool, even though they're not specifically technology. That's fine, too. Yeah. I'm completely okay with that.
The new Mustang Shelby GT500.
Ooh, yeah. See, people listening will get into that.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Hey, thanks. It's great to do this, Sam. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'll talk to you next
week. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. The phone number. Paul in San Diego. Hello, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Leo. I'm in the midst of cutting the cord to the cable.
That sounds so painful.
That was the telephone service.
Yeah.
And so now I moved my number to Google Voice, and the question is, how can I get my old phones to respond to Google Voice?
Right. You don't, by the way, cord cutting doesn't require you giving up phone service. You switched your phone service, I guess, to the cable company, but you can always switch back to the phone company if you want. So if the phone numbers, and that's usually what people want to keep. The phone numbers are precious. Thanks to the FCC, phone numbers are portable. So do you want to, is that what you want to do, is make sure that Google Voice, well, there's two things you can do. One, your Google Voice number can be your old phone number.
Yes, it is.
That way, not confusing anybody. Okay, so that you've done that. That's called porting your number from one service to another. You ported it from the cable company to Google Voice. So you've already done that. So then Google Voice will allow you to ring up to five phones when that number is called. And you just go into the Google Voice setup and you say, add a phone. And it's maybe not completely obvious where to do this, but if you go into settings, you can add another phone. What it'll do to make sure that you're not adding somebody else's phone is it'll ask you, say, I'm okay, we're going to call this phone and enter in this number. And you'll verify that you actually have access to that phone. So
what I meant is to somehow have it ring on my old phones.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You have these old, physically, these old Western digital phones. I understand now. Yes. Western Electric phones, and you want them to ring.
Yes.
I got it. So there, now you need a hardware interface for Google Voice that will turn it into POTS effectively. And there is there are a number of different companies that will make these adapters that basically they connect to the internet because Google Voice is internet only. And I use something called the Obihi. Let me just see if they're still around, because for a while there was some worry that they would stop working with Google Voice. Obitalk is now the name of the company, obitalk.com. And it still works with Google Voice. So this is a really cool little box. You connect it to your internet. It has on it a phone jack. And when somebody calls your Google Voice number, that phone will ring. Furthermore, you can place calls just as if it were a regular phone. But instead of using the phone service, you know, your AT&T service or whatever, it'll use the internet, but it does it transparently to you. So
OBITALK.com.
There's no, what I like about it, there's no subscription fee. You buy it. It's just an interface and it works. And I really like it. I think it also adds some other features that your Google Voice has, things like call recording and so forth. Now, remember, 911 with Google Voice is not the same. You understand all that, right?
Yeah.
Your emergency calls, and this is something Google Voice tells you and Obi will tell you as well. Your emergency calls, which on your plain old telephone service, back when you were with the cable company or before that with the phone company, you dial 911 and they know your location. And even if you don't speak, they can send emergency services and so forth. It's different with the internet. But if you read carefully, they offer an optional 911 service. Google Voice will not do 911. But Obitalk will, for an additional fee, connect you to a regional 911. So I would suggest doing that, frankly.
Okay. Another question, if I can.
Yes, sir.
I currently have a Samsung S9. Well, I should say currently. I'm about to buy one.
Don't buy one yet. Don't buy one yet. Next month, Samsung's announcing the Galaxy S10.
That was my question.
Stop! For two reasons. One, once they announce the S10, I'd expect to see prices go down on earlier Samsung Galaxy phones.
Okay.
So you might, if you still say, no, I like the S9, you'll be able to get a better price on it in a month. Let me see. The Samsung event, they just sent me an invitation. I can't remember the exact date, but this is a big deal because they're doing it a little earlier this year. Usually they wait till Mobile World Congress in the spring, but apparently they want to get a jump on everybody else, so they're going to announce the S10 Plus sooner. I guess they're announcing it February 20th, But that doesn't mean it'll come out until March. So it may be that even though the announcement happens, you don't get a great deal. But I would at least look and see what they're going to do. These will be their first 5G phones. May or may not be important because, you know, your carrier has to offer 5G. And real 5G, by the way, AT&T is offering something they call 5GE, which is not 5G. It's LTE that they're rebranding. Shame on them. So you want to make sure that you get real 5G, but that's your phone will be able to handle it anyway. The other thing about the Samsung announcement on the 20th, they're expected to announce their folding phone. And you may or may not want that, but I think I'd wait and see what that looks like.
This will be for T-Mobile.
Yeah, T-Mobile mocked AT&T for their announcement. T-Mobile, depending on your market, is going to start rolling out 5G towards the end of the year. I think it's premature to buy a 5G phone unless you absolutely know 5G is going to be available over the next year or two. On the other hand, if you're going to keep that phone for 5 years in San Diego, for sure you'll have 5G soon, you know, sooner than that. So it'll be worth having your next phone be a 5G phone just so you can use the 5G service when it's available. 5G is the new high-speed data service that's going to replace LTE. But, you know, it's going to take a little while because it requires far more cell towers than the current system. But once installed, it's a lot faster and has a lot of additional features that I think people will want. 5G, it's widely considered, will be a revolution in smartphone connectivity. But don't be fooled because just this happened with LTE. When LTE was announced, a number of carriers, I think T-Mobile was one of them, rebranded their current slower system as if it were 4G. They called it 4G. 5G, the real 5G setup is not what AT&T is using. It's not what Verizon's using in their home service either. It's something different. You can read about it. But, you know, T-Mobile, I think, is one of the companies that is hoping to get it out fast. Remember, they're hoping to merge with Sprint soon. You know, if they get regulatory approval to do that, and that will be an opportunity for them to make a big move, I think, in the market. And so I'm sticking with T-Mobile for the same reason. I think they're going to be a good future-forward smartphone company. So if that's the case, you might want to look at the S10.
Well, thank you very much, Leo.
You're welcome. February 20th is the announcement. At least by then you'll have some idea. If you can wait 5 weeks, the only thing that's unknown is when that phone will be shipping. And typically they do it, as I said, usually they announce it later and ship it sooner. Maybe they'll announce it earlier and still ship it in mid-March, but maybe not. I don't know. I don't know. We don't know anything about that yet. We will be watching and, of course, covering that event on February 20th because that's a big deal. It's a really big deal. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls next. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We've got smartphones. We've got smartwatches. 888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number if you want to talk tech with me. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Let's go to line three. Manny in Vero Beach, Florida. Hello, Manny.
Hello, how are you, Leo?
I'm great. How are you?
Wonderful, thank you. And thank him for allowing me to talk to you.
She is encouraged to encourage everybody, so I'm glad you called.
If I can slip another question in there, that'd be great. But
Oh, yeah, don't worry.
I want to know what the advantages are of having a paid email service versus, like, Gmail.
Oh, you just opened a can of worms, a kettle of fish. A box of springs. So Gmail's a great service. I love Gmail.
I do too. The thing is, I'm getting so tired of Google just taking over everything.
Well, this is the issue. So if you're not paying for something, they're making money off you somehow. Right.
Right.
Because it's too expensive to give you free email service for nothing. Mm-hmm. That's part one. Part two is there's some things you'll sacrifice with a free service, chiefly support. So unless you pay for Google's email service, many companies do. We use Google's business product, G Suite, in our company. And so then we can call somebody. We have a, you know, as a result, because you're paying $5 per person per month, there's a phone number to call. But support's expensive. And when you're getting a free service like Facebook or Google, don't expect to be able to call somebody. You'll have to use email or chat, and even then the support is weak. So that's one. But the other one is, you know, kind of interesting, because the way, in theory, Yahoo, Google, Microsoft Outlook, they pay for themselves is they put ads on the page. And, you know, that's actually not a bad way. Mail is not that expensive to offer as a service. I pay, I think, $90 for 3 years of paid email service with Fastmail. So it's maybe I'm costing Google $10-15 a year, no more. And they can certainly make that money back with advertising. In the past, Google has mined the data in your email for that advertising. They used to go through the email, look for keywords, and it came up with some pretty creepy results. You know, if somebody writes about, oh, I have to go to my grandpa's funeral tomorrow, they might get ads for caskets and funeral homes, and that's pretty creepy. And I think that Google finally decided that wasn't worth it. So they announced about, it's almost 2 years ago now, that they're going to stop going through people's email looking for keywords. Doesn't mean they're not mining your email for other things. We know that they do, and when I say they, I don't mean a human. Machines do read your email to look for spam content and block spam. So that's one thing they do. Google also has a smart reply feature, which examines the contents of the email and gives you potential responses. And it's quite good. But, of course, the only way they could do that is if the machine's looking at the email. So some people feel like, I don't know. I don't know if I want Google having access to my email. We're not this. Some of this is, do I trust Google? Some of it is, I don't trust Google, because I know that ultimately the way they're making money is on all the data I give them about myself, that is of value to them. Both, you know, for instance, maybe they're not reading your email, but maybe they're noticing subject lines, or maybe they know what you're searching for. They know what you do, how much time you spend. They have a browser. If you use Chrome, they know a lot about you. And that information is valuable to them. And depending on your level of paranoia, this might be something that, you know, you don't want to give them. I go back and forth on this. I just interviewed on Friday a woman who's written a new book coming out Tuesday called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. She really says Google is the leader in this notion of using your data, at first just to sell to you, eventually to predict what you do, and finally, she says, the last stage will be to modify your behavior. And that's a little nervous making. So I moved my email off of Google about 2 years ago. I was on Google for one reason. I used Gmail because it had the best anti-spam filtering out there. It was really good. You didn't, because they use a collaborative system where if people get spam, they flag it. Google has millions of users, so they could say, oh, yeah, a lot of people are saying this is spam. It must be spam, even if the computer doesn't know it, and block it. And that was very effective.
So you use, I think you said Fastmail?
I moved off Google.
You recommend?
Yeah, I love Fastmail. I moved off Google to Fastmail a couple of years ago. They are as capable as Google. Mm-hmm. In some respects, more capable, some of the more geeky respects. They don't do the auto answer, you know, suggested smart replies thing. But they do a very good job of spam filtering. I can set up much more capable filters using their sieve program. I really like it. And the other thing I'm trying out now, and they're going to be a sponsor, so I'll give you that caveat, is a personal email service. There's a company called Helm at thehelm.com, H-E-L-M. You buy a server, and for $90 a year, you can run your email out of your house, which means even Fastmail doesn't see my email. Email's a funny thing, because email's like sending a postcard. You know that. I mean, it's not private. But you don't want the company that has all your email to do anything with it. I trust Fastmail. I don't think they're going to do anything with it. I think they're a very good company, and I don't have a problem with them. But if still, that's a third party that has your email. With your own personal email server, only you have your email and the person you send your email to. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting third way to go. I think for most people, frankly, Gmail's fine. But if you're nervous about Google, than I think Fastmail or a service like it. There are a lot of services. What you look for is an IMAP server. But Fastmail is what they're very much part of the community that creates the IMAP server. They use the Cyrus server, and they're doing a lot of really interesting things, including some new formats for email. I think Fastmail is a great company. So they're an Australian company, and I think it's worth sending them a little money to get the pro version of their email. But if you want kind of really personal, then thehelm.com, and I've been very happy with that. So those are three different levels, depending on your how much tin foil you want to put in your hat.
Right, cool. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And
Ultimately, the other thing for me with email is I get so much of it that I need to control it. And so I have fairly elaborate filtering systems set up. And Fastmail gives me much better filtering than Gmail does. Cool. Much more capable. I can write scripts and so forth in Fastmail, and I really like that.
That's cool. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. That's a good question. Yeah. Lately, I've been really worried about Google. After reading this book, I'm now on, whoa, man. See, I mean, I think we're all willing and understand the trade-off. When you get something for free, Facebook, Google, whatever, you're giving them something. Usually it's your data. And in recent years, it's never bothered me that, well, they know what my interests are, and they're going to give me ads that are more approximate my interest. That makes them a more valuable ad platform. Advertisers say, oh, gosh, we can break down our ads for, certain types of people, men living in Northern California. I can make my ad for them. That's great. And it doesn't bother me, because then I don't see ads I'm not interested in. I don't feel like that's a huge invasion of privacy. But that's, unfortunately, we now know that's not where it stops. The next step after that, this is something we don't do on the radio, I got to tell you. But these new companies, Facebook and Google, are the chief offenders, Microsoft as well, know more about you, and it's more valuable than just what ads to show you. At some point, that information can be used to predict your behavior and ultimately to modify your behavior. And I think, we're just seeing the first glimmers of that with things like Cambridge Analytica and the data they used from Facebook to sway the Brexit vote, for instance. We're just beginning to see companies starting to use it to sway our behavior. And is that something I want to allow? Maybe not. I don't mind customizing ads. Don't really like the idea that they may try to sway my behavior. Facebook had experiments. They were very proud of it, in which they affected people's moods. They tweaked their news feed to see if they could make them happy or sad. This was last year. They got in a lot of trouble for it, not 2 years ago now. But they did it. They know it can be used that way to influence people's state of mind. That's why I got off Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp, the all three Facebook products, and Twitter for that matter, because I don't like that idea. I don't want to give somebody a pathway into my mentality, into what I think. That's advertising. I guess that's the point of advertising, right? Is to influence your thinking. But there's advertising, and then there's behavior modification. I'm not a fan of that by any means. Our show today brought to you by, our podcast today brought to you by Slack. And when I say brought to you by, of course, they're a sponsor, but it's more than that. We use Slack. We use Slack throughout our business, because Slack is the easiest way to keep everybody on the team in touch and working together, collaborating. You no doubt know Slack. Everybody knows Slack because it's the tool for collaboration. It allows you to organize your team with real-time messaging, not just text, but video and voice calls too. Group file sharing. We use G Suite, and it's great because documents are right in the Slack. Searchable archives too, so never any mystery about what did I say? Oh, it's right there. It's all written down. The thing that's good about Slack is your employees like it, and they will use it because it's fun, it's beautiful, it's attractive, and it's so much better than email. Saves time, improves productivity. You don't have to search through emails for that follow-up or search through multiple systems to find what you're looking for. It's all a conversation. And because you can divide Slack up into channels, it's conversations on topic. You see, with our Slack, we have many different channels. We have channels for booking, continuity. That's the ad department, editorial team. The business department has its Slack. We've got each show has its own Slack. It really is a great way to communicate, to stay in touch, to know what's going on. We are big fans, and I know you will be too. It's all there, slack.com, S-L-A-C-K. And because they've got mobile apps for iOS and Android, man, you know, wherever you are, you can be in Slack. But Slack also has office hours, so you can say, don't bother me at home. I like that too. Slack.com, your team is better connected. Learn more. Slack is where work happens at slack.com, S-L-A-C-K, slack.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK, Leo, the phone number. Line 4, Tom, Toronto, Canada. Hello, Tom.
Hi, how are you, Leo?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good, man. I've talked to you a few times, and you're my tech guru, buddy.
Good. Everybody needs one. What can I do to help you?
Okay, so here's a scenario. I use Bluetooth headsets. I've got a few of them, and I've got them all set up, you know, with either some pads at home or my phones. And what happens is when I come home and I want to switch my Bluetooth headsets to my pad or something, I shut off the one on the phone, the Bluetooth, so that it'll just hook up to the pad. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens is when I put the Bluetooth back on, oh, by the way, I got a Google Pixel 2 XL.
Nice phone.
Right. Thanks, yeah. That was, by the way, your
good.
Told me to get that phone.
Good. Oh, I hope you're happy with it then.
Oh, I am very happy, and I'm definitely going to go for the next. I think I'm going to wait for the 4 or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah, there'll be another, you know, there's one every year, and most people don't want to upgrade every year, so it makes sense to skip
it. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the cameras on these phones are amazing.
Oh, I love
it. My wife loves it. She never sees the camera. It's so good, you know?
And to Google's credit, they a lot of the features they added to the Pixel 3, they downported to the camera app in Pixel 2.
Exactly. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So anyways, my problem is when I switch my Bluetooth back on my phone, and because I've got quite a few apps, like music apps and stuff, I like to fool around with them all. What happens is, since I put on my Bluetooth, all those apps start up by themselves.
In
the background.
I hate that.
And I've tried. I use this thing called what's it called? Shut App. It's not on the Play Store anymore, unfortunately. But I still like using it. It's a small little app where you just press on the button or whatever, and it just kills all the apps that you set up to kill.
Yeah.
You can make a white list for stuff not to kill, right?
Yeah.
So it does a quick job and it kills them all. So what happens is, as soon as I put on my Bluetooth, all these, and I use the kill app, I see like 20 apps all boom, 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 being killed again. I'm like, why? Why is it? And I've gone through, you know, the setup and everything, the you know, to find out app permissions and all that, but I don't seem to figure out.
You're not going to like my answer. There may be a way to prevent that, but you're not going to like my answer, which is
you're
messing with it too much. Just leave it alone. The reason that the kill app disappeared is it's not a recommended behavior to kill apps. They will backgrounded apps will automatically be terminated. Their resources will be reallocated. There may be a little bit of them sitting there, but it's okay. In other words, let the phone manage that. So it used to be, I think we probably even showed people how to do it in the old days. You'd go through your recents. My wife still does it. I keep telling her, you don't need to do that. Go through the recents and close everything.
That's right.
Yeah. Instead, you got an app that does it automatically. It's not a good idea. I think one of the things people think is going to save battery life, it does not. In fact, it worsens battery life because it takes more resources to reload that application into memory. You can let the phone do it. In the last three versions of Android, the background tasks. In fact, people have been complaining because. Oh, see, I knew he wouldn't like it. He just hung up on me. I'm sure that was just a Bluetooth issue. But in the most recent Pixel 3, they have a much more aggressive background app killer, and people have been complaining about it. Hey, you keep killing my apps. I would let Android do it, and so you don't need the recent killer. Now, I agree that the Bluetooth apps, when Bluetooth gets reconnected, the apps should not be launching. But I guess that's a behavior I don't fully understand, but I would guess it's a behavior that has to do with reconnecting to the Bluetooth, that all the apps that use that Bluetooth then have to be called and informed, oh, it's back, which is another reason why you don't want to kill it. Apps nowadays in mobile devices are designed to sit in the background, to work well in the background, to use minimum resources. In some cases, everything will shut down except that little bit of the app that watches for the Bluetooth, for instance, to reconnect. And instead of reloading the whole app, it'll just go, okay, yeah, I got it. Which is less demanding of your resources, your CPU, your battery life, than what you're doing, which is killing the app and it's forced to restart. So that's probably not something you can block. In fact, I think it is definitely not something you can block. And this is the part you may not like, I don't recommend shutting down your apps. I just don't. I think that now in modern versions of Android, it's not necessary. So it's, in other words, let it do it. Let it do it. It's, you're messing with it. And I think this is a problem that a lot of us have, especially old timers have, because we go back to the days where you had to do all this stuff. You had to manage your memory actively in Windows 95, and you had to pay attention to your disk optimization and things like that. And those days are pretty much gone. Not just on desktop, but especially in mobile, because these are mobile operating systems are more modern. They're designed for resource-constrained environments where battery and CPU and screen time and all of those things come at a high cost. And so they do a lot of management themselves, and to mess with it is to, in general, to make a mistake. So don't close those apps. Somebody in the chat room is mentioning, and I'm not sure if this is the case, but it sounds like it may be accurate, that this is the events receiver that cannot be disabled. We talked about this apparently on Security Now. Some people do want to disable this, but it is part of the way that Android works. I think that makes sense, to be honest. So maybe you disagree. Let me know. TechGuyLabs.com is the website. You can leave a comment there or call 888-ASK. Leah, we will... Oh, we got Tom back. I think his phone disconnected. We'll talk to Tom one more time when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Sorry we lost you, Tom, but I think you heard you heard my unsatisfactory answer.
Yes, I did, sort of. I tried to get it all.
Basically, don't mess with it. Let it do its thing. And the phone...
I understand.
Modern mobiles are designed really to handle all of this stuff much more efficiently than you can. Now, and by the way, that's why the app killer is no longer available in the App Store. Google recommended...
I understand that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Who is the worst for always coming on apps? Is Google Play Store and Google Music. It's always running. No matter what you do, no matter how many times you kill it, boom, it comes right back on again.
Yeah. So I don't remember this part of Security Now, but somebody's telling me that we talked about it, or Steve talked about it on Security Now, and probably as a security hazard, but this event monitor cannot be disabled.
I understand, and I could understand why they're doing that. Yes, it's probably definitely for security reasons. Could be something to do with the 911.
There's lots of reasons. The music, they don't want... The problem is the music program probably gets confused. So when you disconnect the Bluetooth, it gets the signal, Bluetooth's off. Okay, fine. It needs to know, you know, when it launches, that Bluetooth's on. So I'm guessing what's happening is the whole program isn't running in the background. A small part of it is running in the background that is just reattaching the Bluetooth.
Some kind of cache or something.
Yeah.
Could be. You're right. So just don't mess with it. Just let the Android system do its own thing in the background.
Yeah. In general, that's the correct thing to do. If you have a misbehaving app, I mean, if there's an app that's...
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Then get rid of it. I mean, just don't even use it because...
absolutely.
Yeah. And at least that's my advice, Tom.
Okay.
But I said at the end, I know you missed it. I said at the end, if you disagree with me, go to our website, put your comment up there or call me, because I'm sure that people are going to say, well, wait a minute, Leo.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Like I said, some people are sticklers like I am. I'm a stickler when it comes to all these apps running in the background. I don't want them running in the background.
Yeah.
I want to do what I want to do.
They're not really running in the background, is I guess the real
answer. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, don't use my resources, buddy.
Well,
I'll tell you when to use them.
Yeah. And in the old days, you know, like when I was saying, in Windows 95 days, you had to be aggressive about that.
Exactly.
But yeah. Modern operating systems know best. And remember that the phones are, I mean, look, they don't want to put a lot of battery in there. They want it to be as battery efficient as possible. So they're doing everything they can to reduce resource consumption. Yeah. So those,
if I'm not mistaken, Google won't even let some apps, if it's too heavy on it, they won't
run in the background. Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Hey, all right, listen, I really appreciate it. You answered my question.
I'm glad you called, Tom. Thanks.
Like you always have. And you have a great day. Okay?
Bless you, Tom. Take care.
Take care.
Getting everybody's hopes up. We don't have a Chris today. In fact, Chris is gone till March. That's all right. Don't worry about it. It's good. That magic music that tells us it's time for... Oh, no, it's not. Chris Marquardt is on walkabout. Our photo guy, who normally joins us this hour, is on walkabout in New Zealand, the lucky guy. Taking a much-deserved vacation. Most of the time when Chris travels... It's to leave a photo workshop. He does amazing workshops. And in fact, I remember, after his vacation in New Zealand, he'll be going on a workshop, I think to Svalbard in the great north, where the reindeer and Santa Claus live, for a photo workshop. He will be back with us, though. He's going to take a couple of weeks off. He'll be back in March, 6 weeks from now, with his photo segment. So I know that makes you sad, but the good news is I can take more calls. How about that? 8888-ASK-LEO. Shane in Indianapolis. Hello, Shane.
Can you hear me, Leo?
I hear you great. Welcome.
All right, man. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure. What can I do for you?
Okay. So the company I work for, I actually work for Schlage Vox.
Oh, we love Schlage. Good company.
Yeah, but what we're looking at doing is we're getting some more requests for Macs in our environment.
Ah, interesting. Because Schlage makes a number of Bluetooth-enabled locks, you know, home kit locks, that kind of thing. So is that what you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we started off with the developers, and then we moved into some of the VIPs, and that's kind of trickling down into our regular environment.
Do you not work with Macs now? I feel like Schlage does.
A PC shop.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
Well, like I said, our
your products do, but not in house. I get it. I get what you're saying.
Right. Because you know, well, it's an enterprise environment.
Right.
Right. So we're using SSCN to manage machines and all that good stuff.
Oh, that's cool. Do you work in do you work in the manufacturer part of it?
We're desktop engineering, so basically what we do is we make sure that the manufacturing machines don't get updates at the wrong time.
Oh,
and
cool.
You know.
So it's like IT, but it's for manufacture.
Yes.
Very cool.
And we run into quite a lot of problems with the Windows updates.
Yes.
Upgrade.
Yes.
Like 1709 to 1809.
Yes.
Microsoft's solution is, hey, just go ahead and download it from us. And
no.
that's seven gigs per download.
There are a lot. Yeah. There are a lot of IT folks listening going, yeah, like I'm going to install all those updates the minute they're out. No. You want to test them. You want to roll them out.
Right.
And that's why when people have enterprise subscriptions to Windows, they are able to do that. When Microsoft will allow you to do that.
Right.
It's only the home users that can't defer the updates. Although I understand they're going to allow home users to defer for 2 weeks, which is ridiculous.
Yes.
but you understand why. They want home users to be secure. They want them to get those updates.
Yep.
And I don't blame them.
And we did the 1809 right when it came out.
Oi! Big mistake.
Yeah.
Big mistake.
We had a little bit of a problem with that.
Yeah. Tell me about your license for you're not using just individual licenses for your machines. You have a
No. We're using for Windows, we're using KMS server
okay.
and we buy volume license.
You have a volume license. So when you do volume licensing with Microsoft, you're able to defer as long as you want. It was your choice to go to 1809, but they didn't make you do that.
Well, no, they have a deadline.
Really? I thought you could defer it for up to a year with volume licensing.
Well, here's how it works out, though. So we started with 1511.
Yeah.
Then we went to 1607, and then 1709 rolled around, and we had some problems with encryption because we went to McAfee and a few other. We had another product. Well, to build pass sequence to upgrade machines, and it's been a real mess. And it continues to be a mess.
So, I bet Microsoft's listening to you saying, and now we're thinking about Macintosh and going, oh, no. Yeah. That is not what they wanted.
That's really where my question comes in is we've dealt with this with Microsoft. So how – and because I know you have a very mixed environment in your –
Well, for instance, we have volume licenses for our editors because we don't want them to have to upgrade. And those editing machines, I doubt they're even on 1703. Right. We don't upgrade them very fast. Hello? I think his phone was dying. Did you hear that? Yeah, it's cutting in and out. So I gather what your question is. I'll just have to answer on the air, Shane, since we've lost you. I gather what your question is. Do you have the same rigmarole with Mac, with Mac OS? And no, you don't. But you also don't get as much enterprise support. Apple doesn't really have a big enterprise footprint. So, you know, there's no volume licensing because no one pays for the operating system. You get it for free when you buy a Mac, and you get upgrades for free forever. And here's the most important thing. You can defer upgrades as long as you want. In fact, if you buy a Mac today, you never have to upgrade it ever. There are some security patches that are pushed out without even your knowledge. Those you can't defer because you don't know. Gatekeeper, for instance, they have a very nice solution to protect people from installing malicious software called Gatekeeper. And it has a database of known malware, which gets updated automatically. I don't think that's going to cause you a problem. The big operating system updates, you can defer and ignore. The little updates, you can defer and ignore. They do regular security patches, not like Microsoft on a monthly basis, but just kind of ad hoc, and you'll get them from time to time. It'll urge you to do it, but it doesn't force you to do it. So if your one concern is that, and an enterprise, this is different from home users. Now, home users are listening going, oh, I'd like to put off updates. No, don't. Please. Please. That's why Microsoft's Windows 10 Home Edition will only allow you to, until recently, they didn't allow you to put them off at all. And I understand the next version is going to allow you to do a 2-week deferral. 2 weeks is, I think, reasonable. That way, certainly if there's something really wrong with it, you'll know about it within a week or two. I don't think it's prudent to let people defer updates because almost always these security updates are critical. It's different in business. You have an IT department managing these things. You presumably have a managed network. You have your own protections against malware, spyware, all of that. I certainly hope you do. And more importantly, if say you're in manufacture, you have machines, computer-aided manufacture machines that are often very sensitive to updates that can break because it's a specialized product. And so that's completely reasonable for Tom for our caller in his business. For Shane, I should say, in his business to say, oh, we don't want that update. It's going to break our, you know, manufacturer. That's not you at home. You at home, you need to. You're probably not running any weirdo software like that. So you need to do it. Let me see if, are you back, Shane? Did your phone?
I think I'm back.
Yeah, it was going in and out, so I don't know what happened. But
I think it's my internet.
Did you hear my basic answer, which is no, Macintosh lets you defer forever.
Okay. Well, I think my main problem with that is that we don't want them to download it all. Like if they do like Mojave or whatever,
No, they don't download anything unless you specifically request it. Unlike Microsoft, which has announced, by the way, that in the next version of Windows, they're going to reserve 7 gigabytes of your hard drive for updates and caches and things. No, Apple does not do that. They do have a installation partition, but that comes with the Mac from the factory, and it's never changed or expanded. And they don't require you to pre-download. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I don't think that what Microsoft's doing is a good... when I saw 7 gigabytes, I flipped my lid. That's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, which I will say that they fixed it, and it works really, really well. But we can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just no way. Can't do it.
Yeah.
One quick question.
Yes, sir.
One more quick question. I'm trying to get into podcasting. What is a good device for doing remote podcasting? I've been looking at the Zune, and I've been looking at PetScan.
So when you say remote podcasting, do you want to make podcasts, right? Or just listen to them?
Recording the podcast.
Oh, you want to listen to it?
Recording is the hard part.
You want to make them, yeah. So are you going to use Skype? How are you going to be connected to the people remotely?
I'm actually going to go out into the field.
Oh,
and,
I see.
Record them.
Oh, yeah, Zoom is a great choice. I see what you're saying. You want a way to go out, like an old, like radio, like we radio reporters used to do, go out and record and interview people, and then you take it home and edit it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Zoom is a great choice. They make a variety of really great recorders. I presume you're just doing video. I mean audio. Did I say video?
But I'm doing video too, but where that comes in is the audio recording like four people at the same time, you know, lapel mics versus.
Well, the nice thing about the Zoom, the way the Zooms come is with two directional mics. And in many cases, that's sufficient. So you're going to sit around a table and record these?
Yes.
Okay. I'll tell you what I set my daughter up with because she wanted to do this. It's a little more expensive. But Behringer, Behringer. What you really want is a mixer because you're going to have multiple mics and you ideally would like to record each person on a separate channel in case one of them slurps his coffee into the mic every 5 seconds. You could just, you know, edit that part out. If they're all on one channel, you can't, right? So what I got my sister is my daughter is a Behringer X-Air mixer. They're not very expensive, a few $100. And I got her the X-Air 18, which works with an iPad and records individual tracks to an iPad. And then you run some software on the iPad to record it. It's a little complicated, but it is a great way to do multi-track recording in the field. It's very portable. It has something called an auto mix. This is the X-Air 16 I'm holding up here. We got for our field recordings. And that allows you to have, 8 mics. It's probably more than you'd ever need. You can get smaller ones, too, that only do 4 mics. But the advantage of this is that you can have – it's a mixer that does auto mix, which means you don't have to sit and ride the levels the whole time. And these do have very nice preamps. You'll need to then get 4 microphones, 4 microphone cables, et cetera, et cetera. But I think this is a kind of a pro version. There are less expensive, simpler versions. How many people at once? 4?
Maybe 4. I've seen the Zoom. Zoom has a 4-channel handheld.
Yeah.
And I've got a mixer and everything. That's because I play a lot of music, and I've got a.
Oh, so you already have them. So the reason. So here's the deal. I would check with the Zoom if each mic has a separate track. If it does, that's great. If it's all mixed down to a stereo track, that's not as good.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah, if you already do music, you understand the issues here. A mixer will really help you if you can do multi-track recording. What's the podcast going to be about? Manufacture?
No, well, I've got quite a few subjects. music, comedy, music.
Honest. That's great. Have fun. Call me when it's out. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo the phone number. Andrew, Charlotte, North Carolina, you're next. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
It's great. How are you?
Okay. Thanks for asking. Just thought I'd touch base with you. Back in November 15th, I ordered the new MacBook Pro with the AMD Intel chipset, the Vega 20 with the i9 processor.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about 2 weeks to get it in and actually hooked it up to an external monitor via USB Type-C to HDMI and got flickering on the MacBook display. This system was maxed out. It had the 32 gigabytes of RAM. I put a terabyte of flash in there, and then I upgraded it to the Vega 20. The whole thing, whole computer with the student discount was around $4,200.
Holy moly. I have that computer. So, the only thing I didn't do is put a terabyte hard drive in there, terabyte hard drive. I got the same computer, never have any flickering. The flickering, I would say take it to Apple. That's not right.
Yeah, so here's the bottom line. We tried troubleshooting it on the machine, switching adapters, changing external monitors. I thought it may be a grounding issue with the room beside the office. It has two dehumidifiers that run, but actually ran a long extension cable from downstairs kitchen upstairs and was still getting the flickering issue. So I sent the computer back.
Good.
And waited till I got the money, and then reordered one with the exact same specs. Now, if you go to YouTube and just type in i9 Vega VEGA 20 MacBook, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. It'll be the first one to pull up.
Is this your video or somebody else's?
Flickr. It's mine. So type in i9 Vega 20 MacBook Flickr. And actually, when they sent me the replacement, it came in on Christmas Eve, and guess what happened when I hooked it up to the external display?
Was it flickering?
It all
I'm guessing.
So I went on the Mac.
Let me just ask real quick, have you tried it with other external displays just to make sure it's not that display?
Yes.
Okay.
I changed external displays, external display adapters. I had everything running through a Furman power conditioner. Like I said, I've ran extension cables to see whether or not it's the circuitry in my home upstairs. But when I went to the Mac Rumors forum, you'll see that now it looks like a guy started a poll and there's around 60 total submissions, and at least 50% of the computers are being reported with.
Wow. I see, by the way, I'm looking at your video, and the flicker is not constant. It's every once in a while it'll flicker.
It's intermittent, which makes it worse.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And it doesn't do that when you're not hooked up to the external monitor, just when you are.
Oh, yes, it does. And I also tried...
Wait a minute. It does it when you're not hooked? Say again. It does it even if you're not hooked up to an external monitor?
Both.
Okay. Well, yeah.
So we actually,
you need to call Apple. You need to call Apple. That's...
Oh, I have.
And what do they say?
I've been online with the first tier, and they've escalated the second tier, and they have no clue.
But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. They need to, that's broken. That's not right. They need to fix it. If it's flickering, even if you don't have anything external hooked up to it, and it's still flickering, it's broken. They need to fix that.
They had me, the first thing they had me do was upgrade Mojave I think the ones that were shipped out were .1.
They're going to walk you through all sorts of junk because they want to make sure it's not something you're doing to the machine. But you've had two of them in a row now that have done the same thing. It's clearly a flaw. It sounds like, based on what you told me, that it's a common flaw. I'm thrilled I don't have that problem. But don't try to fix this yourself. If there's an Apple store anywhere near you, the first thing I would do, I'm sure there is. You're in Charlotte. The first thing I would do is bring it to an Apple store, make an appointment with a genius, bring it in, turn it on, and show him. And say, fix this. I want a new one. This is my second. And you keep getting new ones at no charge to you. You keep getting new ones until it doesn't do that. It's messed up. It's broken, and I appreciate your desire to fix it yourself, but it's pretty clear. And I have to say, if you follow the MacBook Reddit subreddit, a lot of video problems with these. I now feel fortunate that I didn't have this problem. I have that almost exact same system. Actually, I don't have the new Vega 20. I have the original discrete GPU that they shipped with the i9. But it's clearly an issue. And it's an issue that they have to fix. And the whole, you know, reset the system management controller, reset NVRAM, reinstall Mojave, all that stuff. That, you know, anytime you come to a computer company with a problem with their system, they're going to eliminate all of the software issues first to make sure it's really a physical hardware problem. This strikes me as a real physical hardware problem. And they need to make it good. That's nutty. Now, I'm looking at your video. That would drive me nuts. We have the chat room's feeding me a lot of threads. MacBook Pro, Vega 20 screen flicker. It sounds like it's an issue with that GPU. But they owe you a replacement. That's, you know, that's clearly an issue. It's broken. It's broken. Get it fixed. And it's too bad. It sounds like Apple's having a hard time making these reliably. No computer company makes perfect systems. You know, you're going to have some percentage of systems that have problems. And if you have a problem with a system, especially if it's fresh out of the box and this problem happens, you don't waste time. Make sure it's under warranty and you get it back and say, give me a new one. The nice thing about the Apple store is you can bring it to the genius and show them. And it's pretty hard for them to say, well, I don't know. Is it your power supply? They're going to see it and say, yeah, that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable. And they need to fix it. And I'm just glad I don't have it. I have a MacBook Pro with the i9 that's been very reliable. But, you know, it sounds like I won the lottery because it sounds like a lot of people are having these problems. Some people said Chrome was doing it. Yeah, I've seen the flickering from Chrome. That's not what this is. Is it Chrome? Disable hardware acceleration in Chrome, somebody's saying in the Apple forums. But that would be weird. The Chrome tweak, which is to go to Chrome Preferences Advanced System, turn off, use hardware acceleration when available, seems to flicker it. And this is not just in the Chrome. Fix the flicker. It's not just in the Chrome window. It's the whole screen. Although, wait a minute, I see you're in this forum. I see your post. And I presume you tried turning off the acceleration, right?
Yeah. In fact, I wasn't even using Chrome. I used Firefox.
Yeah, I see that in your post here in the thread. So you don't have take you know make sure you don't have Chrome on there. It's interesting because a number of people say the Chrome tweak helped. But that's clearly not your issue. And, I see no reason why Apple shouldn't fix this for you. This is their problem, right? You've had two of them that did this.
Yeah. What I did was I went out and ordered yesterday after I got my money back, ordered the 13.3-inch and just souped it up.
Yeah.
And I know it's only got 16 gigs of RAM in it, but still it does have a quad core. And so I think what I'm doing, at least I know that that's should be reliable, you know.
It's a shame. I mean, you know, Apple has this reputation as being, you know, magical, and their hardware is magical, but they're going to have problems with hardware. In fact, there's been times when they've had lots of problems with hardware. So, you know, if you see something like this, they're not magical. They're a company. Bring it back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I want to tell you about DigitalOcean. Yeah, our sponsor of our podcast today. Let me fire this sucker up because this is really cool. I only have a couple of minutes. Is it enough time to provision a server, to start my new startup, to get my minimum viable product going? It might be. DigitalOcean is awesome. Let me log into my DigitalOcean account and show you. It is how can I describe this? It's a cloud platform that lets you easily deploy, manage, and scale applications. They call them droplets. Get it? Drops in the ocean. So here you go. Here's my DigitalOcean account. You see, my usage is 61 cents. That's one thing that's cool about DigitalOcean. You only use the resources you need. I will set. Let's set up a droplet real quick. I don't know if I have time. I'm going to do this for you. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets. You choose your operating system. You see, we have a variety here. Or your container distribution. By the way, they now have Kubernetes. But you can even do, and I like this, one-click apps. Let's say I'm interested in learning Node.js. Well, I can set up Node.js on an Ubuntu 18.04 server. Let's choose a. Let's do the least expensive one. I'm going to, let's see, do I want to add backups? Yeah, we'll enable backups. That's $1 a month. I'm going to choose my data center. They're all over the world, New York, San Francisco, Amsterdam, Singapore, London, Frankfurt, Toronto. I always choose San Francisco. I put my SSH keys in there so that I can quickly log in. And I'm going to name this thing Leo's Node. Leo's Node Server. All right, now. Let's create it. In the past, you'd actually have to call up a company, say, I want to provision a service with Ubuntu, a server with Ubuntu. They'd get back to you a week later and say, okay, it's ready. You can start running it. Not DigitalOcean. You can literally spin these up and spin them down in under a minute. 99.99% uptime SLA. Cloud firewalls available, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management. You saw those data centers all over the world. They use enterprise SSDs for speed and easy-to-use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, use DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. And at this price, it's great for learners, too. Look, my server's ready. I got it done. DigitalOcean, do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. do.co/twit. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We've got your smartphones. We've got your smartwatches. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number, 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from everywhere in the U.S., or Canada, outside that area. You can still call free. You just need to use Skype out and call that number. It's a toll-free number. 8888-ASK-LEO. Go back to the phones. Line 3, Gwen in Pomona. Thanks for hanging on, Gwen.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you great. Thanks.
Okay, wonderful. I have a question for you. A couple of them, actually. I have internet service through Spectrum. And it's bundled with voice, which would be the phone.
Right.
Now, I was looking at getting an Orbi tri-band, and it has the modem and the
router. Yeah, so router. With the Orbi, because you have phone service, you'll still need the Spectrum router for the phone service.
Okay.
So typically what they do is they split out the cable and they have one go into a cable modem. And if you have an Orbi that has cable modem capability, you can go into that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other go into the phone router. The phone router is the one that's hooked up to your phone system in your house. And usually they can coexist. I don't have experience doing this with Spectrum. I've done it with Comcast because my mom has that set up. I wish we didn't have to. But if you're going to use phone service from the cable company, yeah, you got to have some way to do that because the Orbi will not do the phone service part.
Okay, yeah, because I was reading on Orbi and it said that if you have the bundle, Orbi won't work.
Right. Well, that's a good question. So really the call is to Spectrum and say, hey, look, I want to use my own router. Here's the problem. Right. You now have one box that does all three, TV, cable, and phone. That came from Spectrum, and you're paying a rental fee usually for that. You could hook up the Orbi to that, but the problem is the Orbi would not then be the router. It would just be a Wi-Fi access point. And while there's nothing wrong with that, it's not going to be as capable. This is true of all these mesh systems. It's not going to be as capable as if it were the router. And the Orbi will say, oh, we really want to be, don't go in bridge mode. You can operate in bridge mode, but we really want to be the router. That way they can do things like determine which devices on the network deserve more service, things like that. They call it QoS or quality of service. So, yeah, it's one of the reasons not to get a triple play package, to be honest.
Okay, yeah, the reason, right now my husband has the router and the modem. And it's not true Spectrum. We refuse to do that.
So you have two networks now.
Yeah.
Well, you could use the Orbi on his system. So you would just, so if he's got a, is it phone service or cable service he has? It's probably DSL, right?
Spectrum, yeah.
Yeah.
It's phone.
Yeah. So you still, so no matter what you have, you need a modem, which takes whatever that signal is coming in from the phone line or the cable line and turns it into Ethernet. And at that point, you can hook it up into a router.
Okay.
So you still need a cable modem or a DSL modem. And in the case of the phone, the Orbi doesn't do that special thing, the phone thing. It's a different kind of modem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And the reason I was thinking of buying, upgrading to what I've got is because I bought a Netmaster box and I wanted to get rid of DirecTV.
Ah, yes.
So now my TV is telling me when I do a test on it, I don't have enough megabytes in there to service. I'm paying for 300 meg to Spectrum. But
yeah.
When my TV, I do a speed test, it's not high.
So you're on Wi-Fi with the TV.
Right.
So by itself, Wi-Fi does cut the total bandwidth, usually around half, just because of overhead. There's no way you could hook up that Netmaster to your router directly with a wire.
Well, I've got, my husband has a router extender.
No,
and I can put,
that's still Wi-Fi. That's still radio.
Okay.
So yeah, hardwired is going to give you the closest to the 300 megabits. Yeah. You have 300 megabits. That's pretty nice. And really, your Wi-Fi with 300 megabits, how far away is the TV from the Wi-Fi access point?
I have a very small house. It's only 900 square feet.
So it's not very far away.
No.
If you had metal in the walls, maybe that would do it, because that Wi-Fi, you know, goes through walls, but not well. It works best if it's line of sight. You should, if you've truly got 300 megabits from Spectrum, your Wi-Fi should be 150 to 200 megabits. It really should.
Okay.
It may be that your router is old and not supporting the higher speeds.
Well, that's what I thought, too. Maybe we should buy another router then.
But so even if it's an 802.11b router, which is Wi-Fi 2, it's the original Wi-Fi, I think that tapped out. But it should be fast enough for TV. I think I can't remember what that tapped out at, 20 or 30, maybe 40 megabits. Boy, I wonder what are you using as a router now? How old is it?
I think my husband got it probably about 6 years ago.
Yeah, maybe it's out of date.
So I'm just buying one.
You could still use the Orbis. It's not that you don't use the Orbis. You can. You can use them in bridge mode, which means that the Spectrum box is doing the routing, is saying who's who, but the Orbis doing the Wi-Fi. And that should improve your Wi-Fi considerably.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you need, in a house that small, I doubt you need a mesh system. You might just need a good Wi-Fi. Go get an Asus just Wi-Fi access point. A good modern Wi-Fi access point. I think it's going to be fine.
Okay. Yeah. Because I did. I went to Costco and it ticked up next year.
That's fine.
X6S.
That's fine.
And so then I started reading about the Orbi and I thought, well, I don't know which way to go.
Orbi is a mesh system designed for much larger areas.
Oh, okay.
Any single access point should handle about 1,500 square feet.
Oh, okay.
The only issue is, again, you know, mirrors, walls, weird things that can interfere with the signal.
Mm-hmm.
Wi-Fi likes to be line of sight. It likes to have a direct shot from the access point to the receiver. But I think what you got is fine. In fact, it's a good router.
Okay, good. Yeah, so I'll hook that up. Then.
Yeah, put the router. You know, you play with this positioning of the router, you know, keep it away. You know, don't put it behind stuff. Put it somewhere where you can see. I know it's ugly, but put it somewhere where you can see it. It'll probably work better.
I'll have it out in the open.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Out in the open's
good.
Yeah, you don't need the Orbi. That would actually be an overkill, an expense you don't need.
Yeah. All right, super. Thanks for that.
My pleasure.
My call.
Glad to help you with that. Yeah, so 802.11b was nominally 54 megabits, which meant you usually got about, like I said, about half that, maybe 60%. But 30 megabits should still be enough for most TV services. Netflix has a page where they describe how much bandwidth you need for various Netflix quality levels. And they call it their internet speed recommendations. Let me just see what they say. Half a megabit is required. half. 1.5 megabits for, you know, recommended speed. For standard definition, 3 megabits. High definition, 5 megabits. But even Netflix Ultra HD only requires 25 megabits per second. So even if you had an old 802.11b router, if your bandwidth from your provider was 300, you should be getting 25 out of that. I don't know what the problem is. Maybe it's just a new router's in order. It's time. I would upgrade your router every 5 years for sure. Just not only because the technology's changed, but because routers kind of, they get funky after a while. The chat room doesn't like it when I say they wear out, but they wear out. They wear out. They don't operate as well, and that's mostly because of thermal issues. They just heat up. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Somebody's saying that you could put the Spectrum modem router in bridge mode. You can, but I think that would break the phone service. That's the problem, isn't it? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo the phone number. If you hear something on the show and you want to know more or you want to comment, you can do that at our website, techguylabs.com. That's free. There's no sign up required or anything. Techguylabs.com. And everything we talk about on the show is there, links and so forth, plus audio and video from the show after the fact. So I wanted to let you know about that. There's also a great chat room that's going on in behind the scenes, people who are listening, and they're often very helpful as well. Yeah, you can go to irc.twit.tv in your browser and join them there. It's family friendly. Don't worry, we keep it very heavily moderated. Great mods in there, keeping it on track and safe for all. Alan in Jacksonville, Florida. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Alan.
Leo, happy new year to you, buddy. How's it going?
It's going great. Happy new year to you. Looking forward to 2019?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Good man.
Leo, I'm trying to cut the cord with our Comcast, and I want to know, is there any way to Bluetooth my music service through Bluetooth on my laptop?
Bluetooth it to what?
To
speakers?
I have a couple of music service.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You mean if you didn't have internet access, would you be able to use Bluetooth?
That is correct.
No. Alas. Bluetooth only goes 30 feet. So unless the music service is within 30 feet of you, no. Yeah, no, you need. So cord cutting, this is actually the dirty little secret of cord cutting. You can kick your cable company to the curb, but you still need internet access, and the problem is, in most cases, people have really only two choices. They have the phone company or the cable company, and both of them are terrible. They overcharge you. They give you poor service. They watch what you do. Often they have bandwidth caps. It means you can't watch what you want to watch. It's a really terrible situation we're in. And if you cut the cable out, one of the things they do is they'll raise the cost of internet. They're going to get their $100 out of you one way or the other. That's their plan anyway. Yeah.
Well, I can Bluetooth my my music from my phone to my stereo.
Oh, well, if you want, you know, your phone has internet access. If you want to get rid of your home internet access and just use your phone, sure, you can do that.
Yeah, but see, the problem is I wanted to use the laptop instead of
you do have internet access. You have it through your cell phone. So you can get your cell phone to become an internet service provider, put it in something called hotspot mode. Now, sometimes your phone company will charge you $10 a month or $20 a month extra for that. In some cases, not. Just depends on who your phone company is. But your phone can turn into a wireless access point, a Wi-Fi access point, in effect, for your laptop. And then your laptop can play the music because it's getting internet, but it's not getting it from the cable company. It's getting it from your phone.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I have that T-Mobile hotspot.
Yeah, T-Mobile doesn't charge for hotspotting. So now the thing to remember is you're going to use more bandwidth that way. If a lot of people want to use their cell phone as their internet service provider, but they quickly realize that the phone companies don't want them to do that. So they put bandwidth caps on there that are considerably lower than the bandwidth caps on your internet service provider at home. And they charge you a little bit more as well. But if you have T-Mobile, look at your plan, see how much bandwidth you can use. Music isn't really terribly bandwidth heavy. It's video that's bad. Watching Netflix uses as much as a gigabyte an hour.
Yeah.
So, if you watch Netflix a couple hours every day, you'd run through your data cap pretty quick. On the other hand, a couple hours of music a day is just going to be a couple hundred megabytes. That's not going to be too bad.
Yeah.
So I would try hotspotting and just see. You might check to see what your bandwidth deal is with T-Mobile. You know, it's hard because they almost always say unlimited, but that's almost always a lie. So what you do is you look and see the fine print under the part where they say, you know, $70 a month, T-Mobile One, $70 a month, unlimited bandwidth. And then you look down and it says, unless you use more than, and I can't remember what it is, 50 gigabytes, and then we're going to slow you way down. So you get 20 gigabytes, according on T-Mobile One, you get 20 gigabytes a month of hotspot. Again, probably, you know, that'd be 20 hours of Netflix. That might be all right, or YouTube. But it's a lot more of music. The other thing to remember is, this is an interesting conundrum. T-Mobile does something called zero rating. They don't charge you for a number of music services. They don't charge it against your bandwidth. So if you're listening to, say, Spotify on your phone, it doesn't count against your total bandwidth. However, I'm guessing, and I'm almost positive, it does count against your hotspotting. They don't zero rate Spotify on your hotspot. Now, you may be able to tether or do other ways of getting internet from your phone to your computer that they don't notice. Then you'd get true unlimited music, depending on which service you're using. I now understand maybe why you're asking about Bluetooth, because then if you use Bluetooth, in other words, used your laptop as Bluetooth speakers, the phone wouldn't say it's in a hotspot mode and you'd have unlimited streaming of music. I get it. That's an interesting question. I don't think you can use a laptop as Bluetooth speakers. You can use Bluetooth speakers as Bluetooth speakers, though. So maybe just get a nice pair of Bluetooth speakers. There are lots of good ones, not very expensive, and stream from your phone to that. And then it would not count against your bandwidth. You could take advantage of zero rating. I'm not a fan of zero rating, which might surprise you. It sounds like a good deal, right? Well, this is great. I don't have to pay for there's no bandwidth cost to using Spotify or other music services. That's great. Well, yeah, except it's putting T-Mobile in the position of picking winners and losers on the internet. Because, for instance, let's say you want to listen to the tech guy on the stream. Well, that'll cost you data. Listen to Spotify doesn't cost you data, but listen to me, it does. Now T-Mobile's picking winners. And that's why it's against what we call net neutrality. I believe, the internet service providers shouldn't pick winners. They should provide equal access to all internet services without charging you extra for individuals or charging you less. Same thing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Somebody in the chat room sent me a link to an article on a site called TechWalla claims you can hook up your laptop to your phone and play music back through the laptop, but I don't know exactly how that would work. So I tried it. The problem is the way Bluetooth works. It needs, your laptop would have to have a profile called A2DP or aptX or one of the Bluetooth speaker profiles that would take a Bluetooth signal from your phone and play it, and your phone would have to see your laptop as speakers. Now, maybe there's a way to get that working. You certainly can play to your laptop using casting technologies. And so, and really, I think the best way, if you want to listen to music, you've got internet only, you know, cut the cord, you don't have internet to your laptop, but you have internet to your phone. Well, listen to the music on the phone. You can play that music to a Bluetooth speaker. It'll be just like a stereo. It'll work great. 8888 to ask Leo the phone number. Beck, we go to the phones right now on line two. Rick in Port Charlotte, Florida. Hello, Rick.
Hello. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Okay.
Question on kind of continuing with the routers and modems. I live kind of out in the country, and all we have is DSL. I don't have an option for cable.
Yeah.
So I have a separate modem and a separate router. And if I'm traveling, you know, I get cameras from security cameras. And, of course, the power goes out here, well, not quite often, but often enough. And when it does, they come up in contention. And, of course, when I lose my cameras, I can't watch them until I come home and reset both of them and bring them up in the proper order. So the second problem I've got is, you know, the best I can do on a download is 6.5 to 7 meg. I'm looking for help on going maybe with a 2-in-1 router modem combination, what I should look for, and B, what should I try to do to maximize my throughput so I can watch something streaming without it all of a sudden, you know, buffering and stuff on me.
Right. When you connect directly to the DSL modem, do you get more speed than on the wireless part? That's
really.
That's going to be the best speed you're going to get, yeah. Is why I'm asking yeah. that.
I typically keep it wired all the time.
Okay. So. See, the limitation is DSL here. Because you're in a rural area, DSL, which is a technology the phone company developed as a way of sending data down a voice line, a two-wire mm-hmm. plain old telephone line, is limited in distance. And past 2 miles away from the central office, it doesn't work at all. And it gets slower and slower as it gets farther away. So you are probably right on the edge of what works.
Right.
How far out of town are you?
Well, I'm 2 miles from any commercial activity or business
yeah.
activities.
So,
I don't know if they have an office there or where they're.
You might be, you're lucky you're getting 8 megabits. Let's put it that way. So that's the real limit. And nothing, no equipment you can add to your end is going to fix that.
Okay.
You might talk to your DSL provider or talk, you know, one of the things about DSL that's different than a cable modem is the FCC requires phone companies to allow third parties access to their wires. So
right.
you can, with DSL, usually get it not only from the incumbent carrier, from AT&T or Frontier or whoever your phone company is.
CenturyLink, yeah.
CenturyLink. But you may also be able to get it from a third party like DSL Extreme or somebody else. Now, they can't fix the problem of distance, but they may be offering better DSL technologies. There's newer technologies like ADSL2. In some cases, they'll bond two ADSL lines together to get you better throughput. There may be ways, but it has to happen at the office. It can't happen at your end. So you might check around. My guess is I'm impressed you're getting 8 megabits.
I'm getting 6.5, 7 is probably the best I do. So.
Yeah, it's because you're right at the edge of the capability. If you got your neighbors a mile farther out of town aren't getting anything.
That could very well be true. Yeah.
So is it CenturyLink you're getting the service from?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, you might ask them. They may have some better technology out there, but my guess is they'll say, "Well, sir, I'm sorry, you're so far away. This is the best we can do."
Yeah, it's not feasible to build another office or something. So,
well, and by the way, I'm starting to hear about DSL providers doing that. The other thing some providers are doing is going to fiber. But the same reason you don't have cable is the reason you don't have fiber.
Right.
It's expensive to trench out. And when you're trenching out to areas where the population density is light, you know, there's no money in it.
I agree. And that's my issue out here.
Benefit. You live in a beautiful area. Your neighbors are far away. You've got land. But you don't have internet. That's the trade-off. Now there are internet services that don't require trenching, microwave sometimes, and you might check and see if there's a WISP, a wireless internet service provider in your area. And then of course there's always satellite. But honestly, satellite's not very economical because not only do you have to buy the gear, but the monthly charge is higher.
It does seem kind of pricey. I checked into that. Yes.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. So this is the trade-off, the price you pay for living in a beautiful area of the country. That's life.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. Should I be looking at combination modem routers so I don't have the problem with the power? Come back up?
Yeah, I mean, if they don't have, you know, this is the one you got from SpectrumLink, whatever it is.
No, I bought this.
You bought your own. And it's one they recommended probably because you want to make sure it's compatible with their gear.
Correct.
Yeah. it may be a newer one would work better. I don't know. But honestly, it's not unheard of, just surely because of the distance you are from central office, that 6 megabits, that sounds actually pretty good for your distance. So you just, hope that somebody comes up with a better solution. This is where 5G maybe will be your savior. It's got the same problem, though, as cable and DSL, which is the 5G, which is a new, very high-speed cellular data service. And I think in a lot of areas in the next few years, 5G is going to replace even line service. But here's the problem. It requires more cell towers, far more cell towers than the old service, which means it's the same problem. You live in a population light area. They're not going to put out 20 extra cell towers just to get to the 12 people that are out there.
Correct, yes.
So, I think there is some motivation to get 5G out there, because remember, those towers will also provide cellular connectivity, and it may be that they're, because they've got more than just data services on there, they may have some incentive to get it out in rural areas too. So, hold out hope that they're going to do that. Yeah. The potential for 5G is really excellent. We started a gigabit. A gigabit per second, which is a little faster than what you're getting.
Yeah, just a bit.
Just a tiny, tiny bit. So there really is a lot of potential there, and I'm hoping that it's going to be rolled out. It should be. This is where I think the government could step in. There was a plan, a broadband plan. I don't know what the FCC thinks of it these days. I think they've rolled back in a lot of government spending. But there was a plan at one point, much like during the Depression, they brought electrification to rural area. You have electricity because of government rural electrification, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because no company, same problem, no company's going to wire you up for electricity if there's five people out there. So it takes things like government intervention, because it was deemed in the 30s that, everybody ought to have electricity. Well, I think it's deemed in the teens that everybody ought to have internet access. And it would be my hope that at some point, government, whether it's local, state, or federal, would start to wire up these rural areas, because everybody needs to be online, I think.
Yes, yes, I agree.
So maybe 5G will be the solution. A little investment in infrastructure from the government would go a long way towards this. I would like to see it. And then, again, you live. I'm sure it's beautiful out there.
Oh, absolutely. It is.
Do you have any problem with alligators?
Oh, no, we see them all the time. I mean, I'm on a canal. A 40-pound bobcat went through the other day.
Okay. That's beautiful, right? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I used to work with a woman, Gina Smith. I saw a gator eat a dog. A pet. A pet. Well, this is the problem. Somebody's saying, yeah, but why force others to pay for rural internet? That's the whole issue, right, with society and government, is a lot of people don't want to pay for other people. But that's what we live in, a society. That's, you pay your taxes. You are paying for other people. You're paying for roads. You're paying for infrastructure. You're paying for military. That's all for other people, too. Yeah, that's why I frankly, honestly, don't have high hopes for a broadband plan anymore. People don't want to pay for anything. Leo Laporte in the Little East Bay Greece here. 8888, ask Leo. Oh, I gave you the number, but I think this is our last segment of the week. Oh, no. I'll be back next week, though, with lots more to talk about. Tech just never stops, does it? Constantly changing, constantly new stuff. I love it for that reason. Richard from West L.A., he's on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Leo. Good to talk.
Good to talk to you.
All the computer stuff being put into cars, are they going to be more susceptible to hacking?
They already are. In fact, if there was a 60 Minutes piece, you can go back and watch it on YouTube. A couple of hackers, I think George Hotz was one of them, showed how easy it was. Now, you had to be within a few hundred feet of the car, but to hack the car's internet interface, get in, and they actually scared the 60 Minutes reporter quite a bit by applying the brakes without him doing anything, accelerating. You can imagine the kinds of problems this would have. The reason is we're now connecting our cars to the internet. That means there's a path in, And unfortunately, in at least the cars that are on the road these days, not a lot of attention was paid to security. So the computer that controls, for instance, the brakes is often on the same CAN bus network as the computer that controls the entertainment system. And if there's a flaw in the entertainment system, then sometimes that can be used to get into the control system, and that is scary. Good news, I have not yet heard of anything being done in the wild. Of course, you might not know. I mean, it might be like cutting the brake line and people just have a crash and nobody knows, right? There are other hacks that are I have heard about that are more prevalent, and these have to do with the keyless entry systems in a lot of cars. You know, if you have a fob that when you get close to the car, it unlocks and you can get in, as I do, there's a potential risk there, too. In fact, you can go on to eBay and for $20 or $30 buy a little amplifier. Bad guys have been known to use these. The amplifier, if your fob is in within, you know, maybe it's in the house, you went inside, you put it down, and but it's near a window, and your car is just outside, the guy can walk up to your car, pick up your fob, amplify it strongly enough so that your car thinks it's you standing next to the car, open up the door. He can even start the car and drive away. This is a very common exploit nowadays. And for that reason, a lot of people keep their keys in a wire mesh bag that blocks the signal. Not a bad idea to get one of those if, you know, when you go home, your keys are fairly close to where your car is parked and your car is parked, you know, on the street or somewhere accessible. I think my Tesla allows me to turn on a pin. It's a little inconvenient, but I have to enter a 4-digit number before I can start the car. It doesn't keep a bad guy from entering it and stealing my stuff, but at least it keeps him from driving away. So as you can see, there are potential problems. And because, like every other company and business out there, car companies have kind of not paid much attention to security. They've got some catching up to do. They're certainly aware of it now, thanks to things like that 60 Minutes piece. But it takes a while. You know, your car is years old in most cases. It takes them 5 years to design a new platform. We talked about this a little earlier with Sam Abul-Samid, our car guy, and we'll talk, I'm sure, much more about it over the weeks to come because it is an issue. I guess the question is there anything you can do about it? As I said, it's unlikely that somebody's going to reprogram your car to get in an accident. Much more likely that somebody might use your fobless, you know, keyless entry system to get into your car, in which case it'd probably be a good idea. You can get them on Amazon for inexpensively to get you can buy a bag or a case that has metal mesh on the inside. It's metal mesh fabric that blocks RF radio frequency, and it prevents this kind of attack. So it's probably a worthwhile thing to get one of those little baggies with the mesh inside. I'm glad you asked, though. It's a good question because I think people need to be aware of it. Thank you, Richard. I appreciate it. Bob, you may know him as Slob in New Jersey.
Hey,
Bob.
Yes. It's been a long time since we spoke. I do a lot of computer support, and my question is, a lot of end users are always clamoring for hand-holding and teaching. I have zero-level patience. The Apple Store no longer has one-on-one training. So how do we solve that problem if people have that desire to learn?
I know. You know, my 16-year-old wants to learn how to program, and his buddies do, too. And I said, oh, I'll teach you. And then I thought, oh, boy. Because you're right. As geeks, and by the way, this is the worst thing geeks can do. We get it all. People will invite a geek over to help them with their system. We'll sit down at the computer, go, okay, it's fixed, and leave. And it's the worst thing you can do. I understand why you do it. I do it, too. But it doesn't help anybody because they're left, and then they end up calling me with a system they can't figure out or something's gone wrong, and it's kind of a mess. Besides learning patience, Bob, I think we do owe it. I think one thing I try to do is remember when I was new, and fortunately, because I'm always learning something new in this business, I'm always new at something. new now at learning how autonomous vehicles work and the computer systems in cars. So it's easy for me to remember what it was like when I had a beginner's mind. It's probably useful to think back to that and remember that somebody sat down and taught you, or you maybe you went to a book or, nowadays a YouTube video, but somebody took the time to teach you and just kind of try to pay it forward.
It was you.
Maybe it was me. There are
screensavers.
I think that was a good show. For 6 years we did that, and I think we taught a lot of people. We at least gave people, I think, the feeling that it's okay to be a geek. You know, it's okay to be into this stuff. It's a good thing. And, of course, a lot of those people have gone on to make a lot of money in technology. So I'm proud of that. I would say the other thing to do is refer people. You're right. The Apple one-on-one thing was wonderful. There are still community colleges, varying quality. You know, some teachers are good, some aren't. Often there are local extension courses with local universities and so forth. And, you know, I've seen I've actually helped out at senior centers that have education classes for seniors, things like that. Look around. But you're right. When people come to you, you could just say, well, do what I did. Go get a computer magazine. Oh, whoops.
Yeah, they're gone.
Shifting
gears real quick. How many miles you got on your e-bike now?
Oh, I got 91 miles on one of them. I love that thing. E-bikes are a revelation. There's an example of something where I'm learning as a beginner all about these. I think they're the biggest thing to happen to bicycling since the wheel.
4,960. I'm going to break 5,000, and that's in a year and a half.
What kind of e-bike do you ride?
Trek Super Commuter.
So these are bikes, if folks who don't know, they started in China where bicycling was just the way. People couldn't afford cars, and eventually they figured out if you put a little electric hub motor in the rear wheel, it can assist you. It doesn't replace pedaling, but when you're going uphill, it can assist you, and it makes it a lot more fun to ride a bike. You still pedal most of the time, but you don't get stuck on those really steep hills anymore. And
yeah, I call it too poop to pump to participate.
That's easy for you to say, but it really makes bicycling a lot of fun. And for people of a certain age like me who really don't want to stress the knees and, you know, the back, and but still love, I've loved bicycling since I was a kid. This has given new life to the hobby of bicycling. I'm ashamed to say it's only 90 miles. It should be more. I should probably ride it to work, but I love my e-bike, and I have several of them, a couple from Rad Power, which are fairly affordable, radpower.com. And I just got the Super 73 from Lithium Cycles, which is really an electric scooter, to be honest. It has pedals, but that's just so you don't get a ticket. It's a lot of fun. Thanks to Big Pee-wee, our musical director, to our phone angel, Kim Schaffer. Thanks to you for joining me. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T, it stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.